and welcome to Mothers of Invention. I'm Maeve Higgins. I'm a comedian and author. I live in New York. I've got one dog and one houseplant, and I can never remember their names. Sitting across from me is, well, I'm sure our listeners know by now who you are.
Thank you, Maeve.
Yes.
I'm Mary Robinson, and I became the first female president of Ireland when Maeve was only 8 years old.
Mm-hmm.
Now, Maeve, how old are you at this stage? Well, you look about 50, but it couldn't be, because that would make me about 100.
I did just have a long flight, but I'm nowhere close to 50. Am I? I don't know. I'm 37 years old.
Anyway, after my time as president, I became the UN High Commissioner for Human Rights, which did lead me into the heart of climate justice. And that's really what this podcast is all about.
That's right. So we are the Dream Team, and our show introduces you to women from all over the world who are tackling climate change in radical ways. That's because although climate change might be a man-made problem,
we know that it has a feminist solution.
So today we're focusing on public health.
And it would be remiss of us to talk about climate change as a health consideration without mentioning the wonderful Lancet Countdown project, which came out just last year.
Yeah, so the Lancet is the hugely respected peer-reviewed medical journal.
Exactly. And I recall at that Paris Climate Convention in 2015 that we talked around the table about agreeing to commit to the particular goals that would mean that we wouldn't let the global temperature rise.
Yes, I'm sorry, I know this one. We wouldn't let them rise by more than 1.5 degrees centigrade above what they were in pre-industrial times, which was about 150 years ago.
I'm very, very impressed.
Thank you.
Maeve. I mean, you're coming on.
Yeah.
That's right. Something hugely important in the Paris Agreement was the preamble, which referred to a significant number of human rights that had to be respected, including, of course, the right to health. And another significant achievement of the Paris Agreement was a commitment to research, to understanding climate change, so that nations can respond to it better and faster.
For this episode on health, we're going to hear from all sorts of mothers of invention, like Stella Hartinger, one of the authors of the Lancet Countdown report, which aims to spur public health stakeholders on to track climate change.
What we know now is that really climate change threatens to undermine the last 50 years of gains in public health.
We'll meet a young woman who reveals why environmental justice has always been part of the Black Lives Matter movement.
I started a group with my friends called Women of Color Speak Out that works to make the environmental movement less racist and get more people of color involved in the environmental movement.
And we'll meet Anne Polina, an Indigenous woman and scientist from the Kimberley region of Australia, who'll share her insight into the spiritual implications climate change has had on her community and the world at large.
When you get these big developments, there's a total disconnect and a severing of people's ability to go and connect with very, very special places.
And the incredible story of Siwatu Salama Ra, a young environmental activist in Detroit who has found herself behind bars.
I'm in this courtroom watching them as they take her away from me for doing what she felt, what I felt, what we felt was our right.
A great collection of mothers of invention.
Definitely. So the research, the right to health, that's where the Lancet Medical Journal comes in?
Yes. The Lancet really kickstarted a movement to galvanise different public health stakeholders across the world to start tracking the effects of climate change through global public health. This is extremely important.
Yeah, that's brilliant, because on the line to help us understand this a little bit more, we have one of the authors of the report. She is our mother of invention all the way from Lima in Peru. Hello, Dr. Stella Hartinger.
Hello, Maeve. Hello, Mary. How are you?
Hello, Stella. You bring back memories of the COP in Lima, which I enjoyed very much when I was there a few years ago.
Yes, that's amazing. It was a really, really nice meeting.
Are you based there or doing work from there?
I'm based here, yeah. I work at Cayetano de la University.
Ah, very good.
You are the director of the Integrated Development, Health and Environment Unit. So you are the perfect person to work on this report. And can you tell us about it and what you found in the report?
I'm part of a group of authors with more than 50 people that come from 24 different institutions across all continents that cover a variety of disciplines. This is a living, breathing project that will grow and develop continuously up until 2030. It's been an interesting first year with incredible results. What we know now is that really climate change threatens to undermine the last 50 years of gains in public health.
So I'm sorry, you said that climate change basically undoes the last 50 years of medical health gains?
Yeah, in gains in public health, that's correct.
Oh my God.
The rising temperatures lead to falling productivity. Mm. Just in 2016, nearly a million people were driven out of the workforce. Heat waves have increased, exposing 150 million people in 2015 alone. Undernutrition is the largest health impact of climate change. Basically, 1 degree Celsius increases the global temperature and leads to a 6% decline in wheat yield and 10% decline in rice yield, which is a lot.
Yeah. And also you track diseases. I'm like almost afraid to ask you, what about diseases and climate change and public health?
Yeah. Air pollution, for example, linked to coal power, transportation and fossil fuels, have led to over 800,000 premature and avoidable deaths in 2015. And of course, we have an increase in transmittable diseases such as dengue. Now we're having a ballpark figure between 50 and 100 million people infected yearly.
There are also, unfortunately, people who are more at risk and more vulnerable than others. Tell us a little about that as well.
It is disproportionately, unfortunately, and the most vulnerable are women, children, the old and the poor. And they're coming from the low-income and middle-income countries. Unfortunately, climate change exacerbates social, economic and demographic inequalities. But there will come a point in a near future that if we do not change, everybody will be experiencing what basically now the global south is experiencing. So it's something to consider.
Something to consider. I love how understated you are. So that's just something to consider. It might be happening to some of us now. It's going to happen to all of us soon. So think about that. So you're using the model of kind of like a diagnosis and then a prescription. So say there's a problem like heat wave. What's the prescription?
So on the prescription side, decision makers and public health experts will need to work together to ensure sufficient safe water and shaded areas. Medical staff has to be trained to put people straight into cooling rooms and among other actions.
These are fairly short-term solutions, are they not?
Yeah, unfortunately they are. We know the situation is dire because for the last 25 years, despite all the incredible clear data scientists across the world are offering, but with the majority of countries like China really steering hard to move policies, we are seeing really positive global effects. What this project does is very clearly set out those goals and measures them in a clear way, because in the end, humans are the barometers of what's happening.
But what about mental health? Was that reported on by the Lancet project?
We hope to have, at least in the next report, a framework to promote research along mental health.
Good.
But it's a tough one.
Yeah, it is. And, you know, we see a lot of suicides of farmers, suicides of those who feel that their land has been completely taken away from them or destroyed.
I think, again, one of the greatest things that we have is that health professionals are actually looking into these issues now. They're not just leaving it at research. We're not just stopping when we get the results and we publish them. We're actually moving towards socializing what we're finding to our policymakers, to our constituents, so that we are trying to make a change. And I think that that comprehends every aspect of public health.
That's actually a very important point, that researchers don't just stop with publishing their research, but go out there and socialise it. If only climate scientists would go out and socialise more the problem, but also how we address it. You know,
we should have a party for them.
We're trying. It's difficult for us to socialise.
Well, it's great to have you as a mother of invention. And I know that you are a mother and that you were afraid your children were going to climb all into the podcast, but they haven't so far done so. You must be sitting on them or something. But
no, my husband is just containing them in the kitchen.
Okay. But it's great to have your expert voice on health as part of this podcast. So thank you so much, Stella. When is the next report going to come out?
Yes, the next report is coming out in November of this year.
Good. Well, we will certainly look out for that and maybe have another conversation on the basis of it. And I'm very glad that you will be dealing more with mental health. I think that
yes,
is increasingly important. Yeah.
Thank you so much for having me.
Oh, Stella, thank you. So, Mary, you know that I live in New York and I've done so for about 5 years. And it's been a turbulent time in America during that time. not because of me. But it's a fascinating time to live there. One of the most impressive groups of people, I think, to emerge are Black Lives Matter. They define their mission as to build local power and to intervene in violence inflicted on Black communities by the state and vigilantes. And they're global, too.
I think that's an important point to make. There's no doubt that poorer communities and communities of colour are disproportionately affected.
Yeah, and I even see it living in New York. I can notice signals of climate change. It's not just over there anymore. It's something that's coming home to roost. A tiny thing is ticks have started to come into the city. All of us who have dogs notice now, oh, we have to check our dogs for ticks. And then across America, there's huge things happening. There's significant sea level rises. That's happening in Florida.
Yeah, I think that some things are more important than ticks on your dog, if I may say so, Maeve. However, anyway, but all the more reason to introduce our next wonderful mother of invention. She's a Black Lives Matter activist, and she's a PhD student in Arizona State University. So welcome to the show, Sarah Tekola.
Hi, Sarah.
Hi, nice to meet you guys.
It's great to meet you. Thank you so much for joining us.
Sarah, I wanted to ask you, how do you see the role of women of colour in environmental justice work? People like yourself, but more broadly.
Yeah, so there's a misunderstanding of what Black Lives Matter is. When we look at how state violence and anti-Blackness shows up, it shows up in police violence, which is what the movement became famous for, but it shows up in gentrification in Black communities, in the policies that prevent transportation in Black neighborhoods and takes funding away from schools and creates food deserts and health hazards and puts pollution into Black communities. All of these things are forms of state violence and are what Black Lives Matter is fighting against. I also started a group with my friends called Women of Color Speak Out. We're a group that works to make the environmental movement less racist and get more people of color involved in the environmental movement. When you look at Black Lives Matter, you know, in Phoenix, our chapter is 98% women. And I think that we do the work because we have no other option. We have to do this work because our lives depend on it. And when your life depends on it, you fight a lot differently. I think that's why we're seeing women of color putting in so much work behind the scenes, often unrecognized, because our lives depend on it.
Absolutely. Sarah, in what capacity did you speak in Paris during the Paris Climate Agreement?
You know, before I left, I was excited. I really thought that this was going to be the moment where we would see a change. As a young climate activist, I had been fighting for strong global climate policy. And while I was in Paris, I was with the Grassroots Global Justice Alliance and the Indigenous Environmental Network, two environmental justice groups of communities of color. Most of what we were doing was protesting, which was a little intense given that there was a protest ban going on at the time. But I began to see really what was happening on the inside and saw that it was kind of more of the same fluff. They said that we're going to move towards 1.5 degrees of warming to stay alive. That was something we fought for with Africa and small island nations. And yet there is no accountability built into the policy. And then we have things like the need for adaptation and mitigation strategies for the global south. And this needs to be financed by the global north because they have a duty and responsibility given their pollution. And so I was pretty disappointed at the end of it.
I agree with you that there isn't enough focus on climate finance and on adaptation now being so important because of the impacts of climate change. But I must say, I really did feel that it was a much fairer agreement, not strong enough and not enough accountability, as you say. We're now at the stage of the rule book to increase the accountability, but it's from a weak base and internationally it's hard to do. But we got the local communities and Indigenous peoples platform. We got the gender action plan now that has put gender more strongly into it.
Yeah, I mean, I think that there were more lip service, but as far as what we're seeing with action, I just don't think that it's going to be the space where we're going to see the transformation that is necessary. And so really, I think one of the things that I took away from Paris was that the solutions aren't going to come from top down, but bottom up, building resilient communities.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
So one of the things that we did in South Seattle, where the majority of communities of color live. We ask the community what their needs are, and communities of color are never asked what they need. They're always being told what policymakers think that they need. What we found out from the community was one of the biggest issues is gentrification, and that gentrification really creates issues around resiliency. Right now in South Seattle, from that climate justice survey, we're now working on a strategy to stop displacement. Having moved to Arizona recently, I see the same issue of gentrification. So we've been getting communities engaged, empowering our communities to realize that when we show up, that change happens. We also found that the majority of the funding is not going to our community, and in fact, a huge portion is going to the police. And we said the police don't make us safer, and we don't want more money invested in the police. We want money invested in trees, because trees are a huge issue in Phoenix because we have the heat issue. Because of climate change and the urban heat island effect and the concrete jungle that we live in, the temperatures get so hot in the summertime that being exposed to the elements can sometimes be deadly. There's way more trees in North Phoenix, where the majority of the white community lives, than South Phoenix, where the majority of the black community lives. So there's these historical inequities that contribute to and create a form of state violence. Oftentimes, people don't understand, how is this related to Black Lives Matter? Well, not having access to this infrastructure and not having access to things as natural as trees can actually become forms of state violence.
It's just a lot. Like, what you're doing, your work, your study and your activism, and like, you're still really young, and like, I know that you're creative and you're a poet, and so like, how are you doing? I think it's a rough time at the moment, but how are you doing?
I'm doing well. One of the things that we try to make sure we do in the movement is take care of each other and move away from this efficiency, productivity that capitalism has conditioned us in, but really build relationships. And that's really what keeps me going, is the relationships that I have with my community. One of the things that I've been working on doing is the solidarity work and building solidarity between Black and Latino and Black and Native communities.
That's a really dynamic thing to do.
So just to give a little background, I'm currently working on my PhD, and my dissertation is looking at the connections between colonization and climate change. And I think that the connections lie there, because when you look at the root of it, I think it goes back to colonization. We started degrading the environment to the point of ruin, collapsing ecosystems, over-consuming, and this is related to this extractive relationship that the global north has with the global south. I consider Black people in the United States part of the global south. I consider Indigenous people within the nation part of the global south. It's all colonized people by the global north. When you acknowledge a perpetrator as the West, you see this duty. And so, bringing back to the Paris Climate Accord, it's not out of charity that the global north owes it to the global south funds for
reparations, in a way.
It's reparations. Mm-hmm. It very much is so. Part of Western culture is believing that we can do whatever we want with nature. We can manipulate it to our means. And part of what we consider developed is controlling nature. This cognitive dissonance, I think, is also rooted in climate denialism. Really, the climate solutions calls for decolonization, a spiritual awakening and a change of consciousness. We cannot continue to live this way. It simply is not sustainable. We're going to have to change the way we live, but in order to do that, we're going to have to change the way that we think. That's what we can learn from Indigenous communities. Simply their way of life is a climate solution.
Amazing. Sarah Tacola, thank you so much for joining us here.
That was great, Sarah. Really,
yeah,
great.
We'll see you online, and I can't wait to read your
PhD thesis.
Oh my God.
So make sure you finish it.
Okay.
Thanks so much. Bye.
Okay. Bye. Thanks. Bye.
So I'm sure a lot of that resonated with your own work.
Yeah, I think it's true that we have, through an extractive approach with fossil fuels, put our whole ecosystems that we depend on at risk. And it is true that it's the Western world that profited from this, because it built its economy on fossil fuel. And now the countries that haven't been able to build their economies yet are suffering more, are more vulnerable to climate change. It's a real injustice. I am very interested to read that thesis. So now I think it's a good time to move to Detroit, where there's a story currently unfolding that really brings home everything that we've been talking about up to now. Public health, climate justice, and the challenge that presents people in the most vulnerable communities, not just in the global south, but in the global north as well.
My name is Rhonda Anderson, Rhonda Marie Anderson. I came up during the 60s. I think I was blessed because I never had to leave. I went from the civil rights era right into the labor movement. I was able to use the same skills that I learned during the 60s in the civil rights era, where we gained the biggest gains since emancipation. That was when I started working for Detroiters Working for Environmental Justice as a community organizer. It was easy. It was something I felt in my heart. I've been doing this now for 18 years, but it started happening way before I came around. If you can go into one block and they can tell you 18 people on my block died from cancer, then you know something is wrong. You just don't have the necessary outlets to get the type of information you need. You need science. You need the data. You need the professionals that bring resources with them to say, we're going to do some research and we're going to see exactly what's happening here. Most of these waste disposal sites were in Black communities. The air was worse in Black communities. The water, the soil. This is a damn pattern. Why is it always these people that are being harmed, these people that are being marginalized? Why is it only happening to these people? That became the question, and that became the mission.
My name is Amina Maxey. People call me the trash lady. For 10 years, I've been trying to fight and shut down the Detroit incinerator.
Rhonda Anderson has been a mentor, mother, I call her like OG of environmental justice in Detroit.
Black women have been the foundation of a lot of movements in this country, and it's not always known because they quietly do the work. They really are about pulling community in through authenticity and being real. Also, they live in the communities that have the coal refinery next to it. So they're just as equally concerned about the issue. They're not parachuting in from somewhere else.
A recent campaign that we worked on was the coal-powered plants. We learned that coal-powered plants emit enormous amounts of SO2 and that the health impacts from SO2 is asthma, cardiovascular disease, upper respiratory illnesses. These emissions are having direct impact on individuals' health. We have the highest incidence of infant mortality and maternal mortality. And we can trace some of this, not all of it, but we can trace some of this back to these polluting sources.
So I know Rhonda's daughters, Swatu and Coco. Coco and Swatu both tell stories of being pint-sized at protests with their mom, chanting with the rest of them, and that all started really early.
I would take Coco with me. She learned how to hand out flyers. She understood the critical importance of an issue, a contract or rights for workers. Swatu came at a slightly different time in my life where I was doing a lot of community work. Her name by itself was a statement to how she was raised. Swatu Salama Ra, it meant born during war to bring in peace sent by God. At the time, the Gulf War had started, and I was going to peace demonstrations every Wednesday. And I thought, this might be a real heavy name for a child. But over the course of time, she grew into the name.
The next part of the story comes from Swatu herself. She's actually speaking to us from prison. That's why you'll hear she's on quite a bad phone line. The context of her situation will be explained a little later in the story.
My name is Swatu Salama Ra. I'm from Detroit, Michigan. Environmental justice community activist. That's been my work for the past maybe 16 plus years. You can call me Swatu. Swatu is just fine. I became familiar with my surroundings when my mother started to take me as a young person to these boring meetings and conferences and justice spaces that sometimes as a young person can be kind of tough. The more that my mom would drag me to these meetings, the more I found myself being interested.
She couldn't have been any more than like 14, and they needed some people of color to do this organizing event around the environment. So I'm like, okay, she can do this. And off she goes to Madison, Wisconsin, and she just started traveling and ended up becoming a person in her own right that was doing work around the environment. You know, she's gone to Paris under the banner of environmental justice, climate justice. She's worked with indigenous communities and was very helpful in getting the Extreme Energy Summit here in the city of Detroit.
The work that was happening in the justice spaces, I wanted to take back into my community. That was a struggle. Trying to take what you learned in the justice space back to your communities was sometimes hard because our lingua as activists sometimes does not resonate in the communities that we come from. It was also tough because these are people who are dealing with day-to-day struggles. How can you tell a single mother of four who's working two full-time jobs that she needs to put down what she's doing and talk about the impact of climate change? We as organizers have to change our pitch and the way that we move so that more people feel compelled to move into this one space together. Because if you're telling a young person who is not feeling empowered that, hey, this is what's going on in the world, they're not going to feel that's going to be the work for them. They're not going to feel that it's their duty if they're not going to feel connected. I spend a lot of my time just loving on people, just literally loving on them, saying like, hey, you are powerful. You are beautiful. You are magnificent. You are the one. And I think that, for one, I believe that. I believe that about every young soul, every soul, period.
I'm Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now! Sowatu Salama Ra is no stranger to standing her ground. It was because she did, though, that the 26-year-old pregnant mother may have to give birth while imprisoned. She was unjustly prosecuted and imprisoned, and now in the...
You're listening to Michigan Radio. Sowatu Salama Ra says she acted in self-defense when she pulled a gun on a neighbor last summer. What it could tell us about cases where Black gun owners claim self-defense.
Last year, Sowatu was outside with her mother and her baby Zala. And Zala was playing in her car, you know, kind of playing with the steering wheel. And a person violently rammed their car into Sowatu's car while Zala was in it, and then proceeded to try to run into Mama Rhonda, who's Sowatu's mother. And so Sowatu, in fear for her life and in fear for her family's life, pulled out her gun, which she has a license to carry, and she held it in plain sight to ask the person to leave. And she had already repeatedly asked the person to leave prior to pulling out her weapon. But it was the moment when she realized that this could turn deadly for her family that she pulled out her weapon. And her gun was unloaded. The woman finally left, and they each filed a police report. And as a result of that incident, Sowatu was charged with a felony firearm charge. In the state of Michigan, it comes with a mandatory 2-year prison sentence. So right now, she is imprisoned.
I'm seeing my children being snatched right from me, and there's nothing that I can do. I'm in this courtroom watching them as they take her away from me for doing what she felt, what I felt, what we felt was our right. And so that day, when they took her, and they just took her, because we're believing, oh no, she's 6 months pregnant, surely with her medical condition, and that she has so much support from the community because she has this outstanding reputation. We felt at the very least they would allow her to stay out until she delivered her baby. No, they took her. We work hard, very hard, if not harder than many others, and not asking for any more than any other, but just the simple rights of any human being to live in a safe community, a healthy community, where I can raise my children, my great-grandchildren, so that they can be what they were intended to be, not that they feel prisons.
Like many other places, Detroit, we are fighting for the bare minimum. We're asking for water. We're asking for running water, right? Right now, you have over 18,000 families in the city of Detroit without running water. And so to any human being who has any type of sense, that should anger them, right?
Folks feel that they can take and take and take from Detroit. They can take our youth through the criminal justice system. They can take our health or lives through really awful air that no one can breathe. That they can take the money from our schools and put it into public stadiums for people from outside the city to enjoy. And then they can take and take and take, and that nothing will be done about it. And if people try to do anything about it, we're going to slam down on them so hard that they're not going to want to try again.
So she is in this prison, separated from her newborn baby, her three-year-old. The family is all in prison. You can't imprison a mother and not imprison the entire family.
I think that what we're really good at as organizers to stay afloat of this oppressive system, try to keep our spirits up and thinking of new ways of how we can approach things and how do we stay fresh and how do we stay alive and how do we still encourage, how do we keep fighting and things like that. So I think that you guys were right on with the questions, and whoever called the prison to work this interview out, you know, I really, really appreciate it. So just thank you.
Well, as somebody who's always had a strong sense of justice, I was really shocked by that story. And I love the fact that the community is coming together so strongly to say this isn't fair, this isn't right, and that the circle is widening. I think that's really important.
Absolutely. And if any of our listeners want to support her, you can just go to freesuwatu.org, and that's S-I-W-A-T-U, and you'll find out more there.
Yeah, and the wider the support, the more people who have responsibility will listen. So that's such an unfair, unjust case.
I think, Mary, we can see that mental health and climate change, it's not examined as thoroughly as other areas, like the other areas we saw on the Lancet's Countdown project. But from hearing from our Mothers of Invention today, it's clear to me that it should be.
I very much agree. And that's one of the advantages of speaking to Indigenous communities. They really do have a language to deal with this. And their relationship with the earth is a spiritual one. It's very much linked to well-being and health, if I can put it that way.
Totally. I'm really glad that we have our final Mother of Invention for this episode. This is Dr. Anne Polina. She's a Nyikina Warwa from the Kimberley region of Western Australia. Now, Dr. Anne, you hold a Master of Public Health and Tropical Medicine, a Master of Education, a Master of Arts in Indigenous Social Policy, and you're a Doctor of Philosophy. So welcome to the show.
Mabubayan, ngajinu nilawala and Polina, ngayo imaru araman, and ngamada jara nyigina ngayigina nganga. So in my language, I said, good evening. My name is Anne Polina, and I'm a traditional custodian who belongs to the Fitzroy River. So in terms of property rights, the river owns me. But you're correct. Wow. And the other point is that at the moment, I'm completing a second PhD in health science. So it seems the more I know, the more I don't.
Oh, my God. Oh, my goodness.
And this is Mary. Could I just say to your greeting, Gura Mahogat, which in Irish means thank you very much. So we can have a nice exchange. But I understand, Anne, that you're currently in Perth. And from what I understand, today has been quite a big day for you. So can you tell us a bit more about that?
Yeah, one of the things is, as I said, I'm a traditional custodian and guardian of the Muddawar or the Fitzroy River in the Kimberley.
And today it looks as if for the first time in 40 years, 9 different nations have come together to stand united in regards to protecting and preserving the mighty Fitzroy River, or the Muddawarra, which is also a National Heritage listed river. So I guess particularly in terms of climate change, what we see is that there is a need to really manage our pristine river systems in a way that is going to be conducive to health and well-being. And what we see is civil society under quite a lot of attack, particularly if they're there to defend the environment.
That would be very shocking. And Australia has been criticised quite severely for its climate policy, but then its climate policy deserves that criticism. I mean, you've obviously had a good success today with your announcement of that new collaborative project with Indigenous communities on the water. Can you tell us more about the environmental challenges that you're facing right now?
Well, I think, you know, particularly somewhere like the Kimberleys, I think when you take a little step back and you look at where are these last bastions of biodiversity that are being held and cared for by Indigenous people around the world, it's like the Kimberley, it's absolutely amazing. It has such diversity, and particularly not only diversity in the cultural groups, but diversity in terms of the landscape. But they are now being quickly looked at, and plans are underway for extensive development. Things like extensive fracking on country. I've been in the Environmental Defender's Office defending a coal mine from being built on the Fitzroy River. There's conversations around, you know, large scale and intensive agriculture. So places that were many, many years ago held to be wilderness areas are now coming to the fore in terms of development, wanting to come to these last areas. The north has been quite pristine for a considerable amount of time, but now it seems that we have done quite a lot of damage in the south, and we seem to be migrating towards north, and there's a very big push for northern development. What we're saying is that we need collective wisdom, and one of the things I'm strongly advocating is that Indigenous people have had a millennial experience in a deep relationship with nature. So I think that knowledge and that wisdom, I call it Indigenous science, because it's knowledge, production, adaptation and mitigation. What the old people tell us is look for the signs. We are not anti-development, but we also have a global responsibility in terms of how do we shift from fossil fuel extraction.
And one of the things that I know you're increasingly worried about in Australia is water scarcity. Can you tell us a little about that? How serious is it?
Here in Western Australia, we've got large cities such as Kalgoorlie that are drying up. Water needs to be desalinated and transported thousands of kilometres to these places. So I think water scarcity is something that's going to be much more noticeable.
And do you have a language for how you describe the mental stress or the good feeling of being well in touch with the land?
Well, there has been a legal precedence that's been set in regards to some conversations around the word solisphilia. And solisphilia really talks about what is your feeling, what is your connection to that landscape, what is the memories that you hold, what is your intimate relationship with the land. So people have a feeling for country. And then when that's taken away, there's a solastalgia. So there's a solace that's created in terms of people actually grieving, or they're actually mourning for country. Because one of the things that we believe is that the country is alive and it has its own life force. And so it equates to almost a human death. And one of the things is that when you get these big developments, even though a lot of the companies say that Aboriginal people are entitled to go back, there's a total disconnect and a severing of people's ability to go and connect with very, very special places. So from an English word, those are the two framing. But we also have in our own language a word called lian. And lian is exactly the same sort of concept. It's your moral compass that guides you through life and sustains and builds and regenerates relationships. So when our lian is happy and we have a good feeling and we are connected and we can continue to live the life that we've lived, that is very, very powerful. And it helps us to read country, and it also helps us to know that country is reading us. So it is a lot of stress that's created in regards to these big projects coming onto country, people's inability to access their traditional lands.
Incredible. I've never heard those terms before, but it does remind me of something. Do you remember the word you were talking about before, Mary, from in Irish? And it's like a connection to the land, or like a respect for the land.
Mehel?
Yeah.
Yeah. Mehel is a bit like Ubuntu. We thrive in each other's shadow. It comes from farmers helping each other, having maybe one tractor and otherwise workers on the land, and the tractor moves to the different fields. And if somebody's sick, their field is done, because that's the spirit of Mehel. It's a bit like that. But actually, when you were talking, Anne, I was thinking, we hear about large numbers of farmers committing suicide in India when the stress becomes too much. And I'm wondering, as a woman yourself and with women in Australia, you're trying to cope with this, particularly in the Indigenous community.
There's a lot of poor health. In fact, we in the Kimberley have the highest rate of suicide in the world for our young people. So we are losing amazing human capital at such a horrendous rate, and trying to get all those things together to look at how do we shift from being in a mindset of, to some extent, war. How do we change that towards peacemaking?
So what are you doing? I mean, what are you able to do to counteract this? The suicide rate is terrible. That's very shocking.
It's very, very troublesome. And part of this is, particularly from a health background, is trying to build a very strong argument to government about how do we invest in a cost of a life saved. One of the things that we're doing is that a lot of the women in particular, they're forming quite strong cultural groups and cultural frameworks to be able to take young people back to country, to be able to have time to spend with them on country, to be able to make time to talk about the construction of their identity as who they are as human beings.
And I think it is possible to bring about more transformational change if we just become more human about it and share our experience and stories. What do you think about that, Anne?
Yeah. When I talk to Indigenous people all over the world, basically what we're saying, it's all about story. Sometimes we get quite complicated and we go, oh, there's knowledge and okay, let's look at science. But one of the things I'm seeing, particularly as a scientist, is the fact that we seem to have overwhelming knowledge about what we should be doing to bring about that change. But somehow as scientists, we are failing to connect with ordinary people, with the ordinary human beings. And so what we need is to be able to use the creative side, particularly in the Kimberley, particularly in the north. What we have is so much renewable. We've got wave power, we've got tidal power, we've got geothermal, we've got the sun. And so all of this technology is right here. Where do we head in terms of the new millennium?
And that's where mothers of invention have to make their voices heard and change that.
That's where mothers of invention must stand and be brave and really push the boundaries and say, we can generate prosperity and wealth and we can move towards a sustainable future. It's going to be inclusive of everyone.
Anne, I must say it's been a real pleasure listening to you and seeing your remarkable career and how you bring it together in this actionist way is very impressive.
Yeah, no, look, thank you. It's been a wonderful opportunity to connect and, you know, it's just tongue in cheek. I said to someone, oh, I'm going to be talking to Mary and she used to be who she was and they said, unbelievable.
Maeve thinks she's much more important.
Did you tell anybody that you were talking to me, Anne?
No, but just the idea that you can actually find people like me because, you know, it's very difficult to have a voice. But what my old people say, you've got to stand and you've got to be accountable. And what I see is that there are many good people with good intentions and all of us connecting around the globe, all of us working together, all of us providing a voice for the voiceless, somewhere within that common sense will prevail.
But that's exactly what we want to do in bringing together and finding deliberately mothers of invention like you, Anne. We want to connect, we want to shine a light on the work you're doing, get support for the work you're doing, but also start a kind of movement to have transformative change in the way that you've been describing. I love the emphasis you put on hope, on collaboration and trying to work together with collective wisdom. So I'm really delighted that we did find you and that we've had this wonderful conversation. And I think Maeve and myself have learned a lot.
No, you know, it takes me back to that thing that drives all of us in terms of we have to have hope. And I think this opportunity to work with, you know, particularly like-minded women is the ability to be able to dream a new dream from the nightmare that we have and create this coalition of hope. So thank you for the opportunity. And maybe I'll get a copy of your podcast later on.
Definitely.
Thank you very much.
Okay, good night. Bye.
Good night.
Today we looked at global health in the context of climate change, both the physical and the emotional aspects of it.
Yes, we have heard from women like Stella Hartinger, Sarah Tacola, Rhonda Anderson and her daughter Suwatu Salama Ra and Polina in Western Australia. And they are such a great reminder that it's people power on the ground that will really drive that change. And Mary, you know, we have the information about all of these Mothers of Invention on our website. That's mothersofinvention.online. Thanks for the show today, Mary. What are you up to this afternoon?
I have at least 2 teleconferences because I don't want to travel physically if I can help it.
Yes.
So I do it by voice or I do it by video or whatever. And then
you should get a hologram, like Tupac.
Yeah, I've heard about holograms. I think I've seen them. Is Michael Jackson doing a hologram?
I think he is. Okay. I think that's what he's been up to all this time. You know, we're across the road from the National Gallery and there's a portrait of you in there, isn't there? Why are you making that
Maeve.
Face?
Just don't do that.
I might go and take a selfie and pretend that I'm your kid.
Well, if you've nothing better to do with your time.
It's true. It's true. Okay, thanks, Mary. Thanks, everyone, for listening.
You can find out more about the series, the mothers we've met today, and support them at mothersofinvention.online and follow us for updates and more episodes on Facebook, Twitter and Instagram at Mothers Invent.
If you want to support the podcast, you can do so through Kickstarter's Drip platform. We're in the initial stages, but we're on a serious mission, so your support and encouragement will really spur us along. To support on Drip, head to d.rip/mothersofinvention. Or follow the links on mothersofinvention.online. Mothers of Invention is a production of Doc Society and is made possible by the Compton Foundation and the Wallace Global Fund.
The chief physician and series producer is Lena Prestwood.
Junior doctors were Rian and Licorice, Kim Jenna Durians and Laura Hyde. Surgeon General exec producers are Jess Search and Beattie Finzi. It was stitched up by editor Samuel Shelton Robinson. This episode was given a full assessment and mixed by James McKee and the music composed by Paddington Bear and Kalu. Our theme music is Water Fountain by Tuneyards with kind permission from 4AD and Marriage Records.
Producers for this week's story were Sasha Rain and Ayana Rubio in the USA, and a huge thanks to Ill Weaver.
Our impact producer is Hazel Falk.
Our senior consultants are Iris Andrews, Ed King, Catherine Wilkinson and Suzanne Dalliwell.